content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Hello, this is Fred Woodward for the North Carolina Reading Service. For the next hour, I'll be reading to you from The Week magazine. Today, we're reading from the April 1st, 2022 issue. The cover drawing this week shows a scene from Ukraine. There are four people standing in the street. In the background, you can see one of the Russian tanks that's been destroyed. In the very foreground is President Volodymyr Zelensky in his now familiar army green T-shirt and pants. He's got his arms folded and has a stern look on his face. Back over his left shoulder is a Ukrainian military man with a rocket launcher in his hand. And back over his right shoulder are two look like Ukrainian civilian soldiers in normal clothes, a man and a woman both holding rifles. The headline is, Could Ukraine Win? In a bloody war of attrition, Ukrainians are inflicting huge losses on Russia's army. And that is, in fact, our first main story. We'll start right there. Ukraine battling Russia to a stalemate. What happened? Russia's invasion of Ukraine appeared this week to have bogged down in a bloody stalemate, with many analysts saying its stalled and depleted army had no realistic chance of taking control over Kyiv and other major cities. Ukrainian forces had defeated the initial Russian campaign of this war, said an assessment by the Institute for the Study of War, a U.S.-based think tank. Frustrated with their lack of progress, Russian forces settled into a brutal siege strategy, escalating their use of long-range missiles, rockets, and shelling to devastate cities and towns, destroying infrastructure and killing thousands of citizens. The southern city of Mariupol lay in ruins, with up to 90% of the city destroyed and an estimated 100,000 civilians trapped without food, water, power, or heat. 10 million Ukrainians have fled their homes, and some 3.5 million have left the country, according to the UN. Russian forces hit scores of schools, hospitals, residential buildings, and reportedly even fired on vehicles evacuating women and children. Under fierce assault from Ukrainian forces, the Russian army has lost as many as 40,000 troops, a fifth of its combat forces, through death, capture, injury, and desertion, and lost as much as 10% of its tanks and other equipment, according to NATO estimates. The Russian army is struggling on many fronts, said a senior U.S. defense official, including broken supply lines and jammed communication systems. At least six generals have been killed, say Ukrainian officials, and U.S. officials said they've been unable to identify a commander leading the massive operation. The bottom line is that their command and control is broken down, said retired U.S. Army General David Petraeus. President Biden arrived in Brussels for a round of meetings with NATO allies to discuss increasing military and humanitarian aid and tightening sanctions. Administration officials said he would announce sanctions against hundreds of Russian lawmakers and call for reducing Europe's imports of Russian oil and gas. What the editorial said. Now is not the time to go wobbly on Ukraine, said the Wall Street Journal. As NATO leaders convene, their inclination will be to look for an off-ramp from the devastating conflict. But that's exactly the wrong message to send. Instead, they must repay the Ukrainians' courage and sacrifice with redoubled support and speak of no exit ramp other than complete withdrawal. If Putin declines to take it, the goal should be to inflict as much pain as possible to discourage further aggression and put him in a weak bargaining position. Putin is showing the world his utter depravity, said the New York Post. Shelters were where terrified citizens hide, evacuation convoys ferrying women and children, maternity, hospitals, kindergartens. Putin is leveling them all. Despite the Kremlin's absurd denials, his forces are clearly targeting civilians with zero regard for loss of innocent life. For the demented dictator, terror and destruction is the point. What the columnist said. Most military analysts agree. This war has reached a stalemate, said Holly Elliott in CNBC.com. Stuck and facing high casualties and shortage of food, fuel, and ammunition, Russia has no path to victory. But an increasingly desperate Putin won't back down. Instead, he'll double down on barbarian tactics targeting civilians to terrorize the Ukrainian populace in hopes of breaking its will. Against all odds, the Ukrainians are actually winning, said Max Boot in the Washington Post. The Russians expected to sweep easily into Kyiv, but 4 weeks into a botched operation, their dead and wounded are overwhelming morgues and hospitals in Belarus, and troop morale is reportedly plunging. Invigorated Ukrainian troops are counterattacking in western Ukraine and pushing Russian lines back. And with no clear way to replenish his ranks or materiel, Putin soon won't have much of an army left. His sole choice seems to be whether to lose quickly or slowly. That view is far too optimistic, said Niall Ferguson in Bloomberg. Mariupol may fall any day now, freeing up Russian forces to turn toward Mykolaiv and the real prize, the port city of Odessa. They've rained some 1,200 missiles on Ukraine and have plenty more. To believe that time is on Ukraine's side is a colossal mistake. A prolonged war may kill tens of thousands of civilians, leaving Ukraine utterly devastated and cut in half, handing Putin something that he can plausibly present at home as victory. For Ukraine and the West, there's only one viable outcome, a decisive victory, said Anne Applebaum in The Atlantic. The Ukrainians are fighting not just for sovereignty, but for a set of universal ideas: democracy, the rule of law, and an international order where disputes are resolved by institutions and not warfare. The stakes couldn't be higher. If Putin wins, every former Soviet republic and NATO nation like Poland will be in danger. To deter further NATO involvement, Putin is stoking fears he'll use chemical and nuclear weapons. But for the West, there is only one rule. We cannot be afraid. We must focus only on a single goal, making certain Ukraine prevails. The controversy of the week. Daylight saving time. Should it be made permanent? It's time to lock the clock, said Helene Olin in the Washington Post. Twice yearly, people across the U.S. go through the same stupid ritual that leaves us groggy and out of sorts, moving the clocks forward in March for daylight saving, and then moving them back again for standard time in November. Last week, though, the Senate unanimously approved a measure that would put an end to the century of back and forth and make daylight saving time permanent across the country. If the House also passes the bill and President Biden signs it, hallelujah, said Margaret Hartman in New York Magazine. As Senator Marco Rubio said after introducing the Sunshine Protection Act, permanent daylight saving would give us an extra hour of afternoon sunshine in the winter, encouraging people to shop, eat out, and be active, boosting the economy. And it means we can drop the tradition of pointlessly resetting our clocks twice a year and disrupting our sleep cycles. We hate to be bearers of bad news, said Josh Barrow and Sarah Fay in VerySerious.com. But we've tried this before, and America hated it. During the oil crisis in 1974, the U.S. entered what was supposed to be a two-year experiment with permanent daylight saving time to help save fuel. Americans soon discovered that daylight saving time does not add daylight to the day. It only shifts the daylight into the afternoon from the morning. So in most of the country, the winter sun didn't come up until after 8 a.m. And in the northern latitudes, from New England to Detroit, to Missoula to Washington State, dawn came at 9 a.m. or later. Children were forced to go to school in the pitch black. Ditto for commuting workers. Americans rebelled, and Congress repealed the measure within months. Republicans, Democrats, Northerners, Southerners, virtually everyone agreed we shouldn't endure another winter of this nonsense. This isn't just about having to deal with a bit of pre-dawn gloom, said Randon Charles in Scientific American. Losing out on the hour of morning sun that comes with daylight saving can have far-reaching health effects. Our circadian rhythms are finely tuned to exposure to sunlight. Morning sunlight falling on our optic nerves halts melatonin production and triggers wakefulness. Starting the day in hours of darkness can make you feel like you have jet lag, and being out of sync has been linked to an increased risk of depression, obesity, and even heart disease. That's why we should do the opposite of the current proposal, said Heather Turgeon and Julie Wright in The Atlantic, and make standard time permanent. It would end the irritating clock changing, and standard time is the natural solution that gives people plenty of early sunlight. Our bodies already want to follow the sun. Our clocks should do the same. What? And have the sun rise at 4:30 a.m. in New York in June, wasting hours of sunlight, said Dave Goldner in the New York Daily News. This is the problem with a country as large as the U.S. There is no universally popular solution. In the end, there's only so much daylight to go around. The best solution, said Susan Davis in NPR.org, is to do nothing at all. The current system, daylight savings in summer, standard time in winter, may not be perfect, but it's the products of decades of study and compromise. Congress meddles with that at its peril. Here's our good week, bad week piece. It was a good week for vacationing in Antarctica, where temperatures soared to 70 degrees above average, shattering previous records. Meanwhile, parts of the Arctic were more than 50 degrees warmer than average, with ice nearing the melting point months early. It was a good week for composting, after the first person in Colorado was laid to rest with the remains converted to soil as a greener alternative to cremation. In the process of natural reduction, the deceased corpse decomposes over 6 months in a chamber with wood chips, alfalfa, straw, and microbes. It's a good week for galactic ambition, after Georgia gubernatorial candidate Stacey Abrams, an avowed Trekkie, donned a robe and played the President of United Earth in an episode of Star Trek Discovery. But it was a bad week for machismo, after two leading GOP candidates in the Ohio Senate primary nearly came to blows at a debate. Investment banker Mike Gibbons and State Treasurer Josh Mandel exchanged insults chest to chest, with Gibbons telling Mandel, "You're dealing with the wrong dude," and Mandel replying, "You watch what happens." It was a bad week for big shots, after GOP Senator Ted Cruz was videoed berating a United Airlines ticketing agent in Montana after he was bumped from a flight. "Do you know who I am?" Cruz yelled. And finally, it was a bad week for Miami Beach, which declared a state emergency after tens of thousands of unruly spring breakers took over the city, brawled, fired shots, and stampeded. "This isn't your father's, your mother's spring break," said exasperated Mayor Dan Gelber. The briefing this week is Drawing Lines for Power. Democrats and Republicans spent months fighting over new congressional districts and ended up with a draw. What was the fight about? Control of Congress after the 2022 midterm elections. The Constitution decrees that after each 10-year census, state legislatures can use the results to redraw congressional districts. After the 2020 census, that opportunity ignited fierce partisan battles in many states, with both parties seeking to ensure they'd win as many seats as possible. The principal tool was gerrymandering, using post-voting data and sophisticated algorithms to create district boundaries that zig and zag, sometimes to an absurd degree, to include some voters and exclude others. The GOP historically does this more effectively, but Democrats made a concerted effort this year to match them. Of the states receiving an F grade from the Princeton Gerrymandering Project for highly partisan redistricting, four are controlled by Democrats, New York, Maryland, Illinois, Oregon, and three by the GOP, Texas, North Carolina, Ohio. Democrats have also won some key legal challenges to Republican redistricting. "We're doing a hell of a lot better than pundits thought we would," said Democratic Congressional Campaign Committee Chair Representative Sean Patrick Maloney of New York. In what states did Democrats gain an advantage? In New York, California, Maryland, and Illinois, Democrats used their legislative majorities to redraw districts to enhance their chances of gaining seats in 2022. In New York, voting trends suggest Republicans should hold 9 or 10 of the state's 26 seats. The map Albany Democrats drew leaves Republicans likely to win just 4, with one district in conservative-leaning Staten Island up for grabs because it now includes a populous part of ultra-liberal Brooklyn. Donald Trump won 41% of Illinois' 2020 vote, but the state's new map all but locks Democrats into 13 of 17 seats. Maryland Republicans might not muster a single win. And in the 11 states that delegate redistricting to partisan committees, maps broke mostly in Democrats' favor, especially in California. So far, redistricting has created 11 more districts nationally that lean Democrat. Where did the GOP succeed? Most notably in Texas, Tennessee, and Georgia. In Tennessee, Nashville has been represented by a single House seat held by Democrats for 147 years. This year, Tennessee Republicans split the district into three parts and moved them into surrounding deep red rural districts, meaning that heavily Democratic Nashville will almost certainly have GOP representation going forward. In many other GOP-controlled states, however, court rulings or constitutional amendments limited Republicans' ability to gerrymander. Courts in Florida, Pennsylvania, Ohio, and Virginia rejected GOP efforts to skew maps. In North Carolina, the state Supreme Court threw out a map that would have given Republicans control of 10 out of 14 House seats, despite voters being roughly evenly divided between the parties. Instead, the court let a nonpartisan expert panel draw a balanced map, a ruling that the U.S. Supreme Court let stand. So gerrymandering is legal. It's complicated. In a pivotal case in 2019, the Supreme Court ruled 5-4 along partisan lines that gerrymandering is a political question that is not reviewable by federal courts. In the majority opinion, Chief Justice John Roberts conceded that extreme redistricting can lead to results that reasonably seem unjust. But he said that if voters don't like the districts created by the state legislators, they can vote them out. The court has made one exception, saying that gerrymandering for racial reasons is unconstitutional. The distinction between partisan and racial motives, however, can be slippery. Last month, the Supreme Court let stand an Alabama congressional map that includes only one majority black district out of seven, even though black voters make up 25% of the state's population. The five Supreme Court conservative justices ruled it was too late in the election cycle to intervene. Will the midterms be competitive? Control of the House is still up for grabs, but legislatures drew districts to shield incumbents from serious challengers. So only about 40 seats out of 435 are considered competitive, according to an analysis by the New York Times, down from 73 a decade ago. Political scientists say reduced competition between parties will exacerbate political polarization and gridlock. How so? Traditionally, general elections inspire candidates to move toward the ideological center in an effort to attract swing voters. But when incumbents don't have to worry about losing to the opposition party, they often move further left or right to fend off primary challengers. Nearly 90% of the next House could be made up of lawmakers who face little threat of losing a general election. No state has eliminated competition more aggressively than Texas. In 2020, 12 districts were competitive. After redistricting, just one race out of 38 looks to be close. As a result, Republican Representative Dan Crenshaw says, the real battles now occur within parties. Does this create incentives to avoid governing, he said? Clearly. We'll read a few of the best columns, starting with Why We Need Strong Militaries from Rich Lowry at National Review. When Vladimir Putin invaded Ukraine and seized Crimea in 2014, said Rich Lowry, then Secretary of State John Kerry said that he was behaving in a 19th century fashion. But as we've seen dramatically demonstrated in recent weeks, the truth is that Putin is behaving in a 19th century, 20th century, and 21st century fashion. Liberal internationalists in Europe and the U.S. concluded decades ago that military invasions of peaceful countries, slaughters of civilian populations, and Machtpolitik, the politics of raw power, ended with the fall of the Soviet Union. But Putin's monstrous aggression proves that progress is not inevitable, and that remorseless and power-hungry men will always be with us, no matter how advanced we believe we have become. China, too, is laying claim to a neighboring independent nation, Taiwan, and speaking openly of invasion. The aggressive ambitions of these authoritarian nations serves as a reminder of how essential it is to support the Western order. Flawed as it may be, the alternative is so much worse. Whether we like it or not, protecting our values requires strong militaries and hard power. If anything saves Ukraine, it will be missiles, drones, and artillery, not norms or treaties. The next step in abortion restrictions. For several decades, anti-abortion activists made a strategic decision to portray women who seek to end pregnancies as victims in need of protection, said Mary Ziegler. That time is coming to an end. In anticipation of the Supreme Court overturning Roe v. Wade, Republican-controlled state legislatures are rushing to pass a wave of abortion bills with draconian measures to stop women from getting abortions even in other states. Missouri is now considering several truly eye-popping provisions, including enabling citizens to sue anyone who helps a woman travel out of state to get an abortion. Buying or selling abortion pills would be prosecuted under drug trafficking laws. State legislators even want to make it a felony to perform an abortion in the event of an ectopic pregnancy, in which a fertilized egg implants outside the womb, a condition that can be life-threatening. States know they have little or no power to stop desperate women from ending their pregnancies. So to make an abortion ban work, these states will have to treat individual women as serious criminals whose travel, mail, and medical decisions must be monitored and constrained under the threat of prosecution. That's where we're headed. This column comes from Italy. Orthodox Church splits over Russia. Russia's brutal invasion of Ukraine has driven the Orthodox Church into a great religious crisis, said Stefano Pontecorvo. The war is literally splitting the church and its 260 million followers, half of whom live in either Russia or Ukraine. Russian Patriarch Kirill, a close confidant of President Vladimir Putin, has thrown his support behind the invasion. While Putin sees it as a war of political restoration, Kirill sees Russia's belligerence as a crusade to safeguard Orthodox values and the unity of the faithful. But other Orthodox priests consider it needless brutality, and the Russian Patriarch has come under heavy criticism from his fellow church leaders and even his own faithful for the first time in the history of the Eastern Church. Last week, more than 350 Russian Orthodox priests signed an open letter calling for an immediate end to the fratricidal war against our brothers and sisters in Ukraine. The Russian Orthodox Parish of Amsterdam recently seceded from Kirill's Moscow Patriarchate to protest the war, and other parishes in Europe are expected to follow suit. Kirill already lost control of thousands of Ukrainian parishes in 2018 when they too defected for political reasons and formed the Ukrainian Orthodox Church. This new quest to reclaim those sacred places by force could sunder the church forever. The last word, our feature article, titled this week, Why? From inside devastated Mariupol, Associated Press journalist Mstislav Chernov and Evgeny Malovteka documented the horrors inflicted on civilians by Russia's brutal siege. Mariupol, Ukraine. The bodies of the children all lie here, dumped into this narrow trench hastily dug into the frozen earth of Mariupol, to the constant drumbeat of shelling. There's 18-month-old Kirill, whose shrapnel wound to the head proved to be too much for his little toddler's body. There's 16-year-old Ilya, whose legs were blown up in an explosion during a soccer game at a school field. There's the girl no older than 6 who wore the pajamas with cartoon unicorns, among the first of Mariupol's children to die from a Russian shell. They are stacked together with dozens of others in this mass grave on the outskirts of the city. A man covered in a bright blue tarp, weighed down by stones at the crumbling curb, a woman wrapped in a red and gold bedsheet, her legs neatly bound at the ankles with a scrap of white fabric. Workers toss the bodies in as fast as they can because the less time they spend in the open, the better their own chances of survival. The only thing I want is for this to be finished, raged worker Volodymyr Bykovsky, pulling crinkling black body bags from a truck. Damn them all, those people who started this. More bodies will come from streets where they are everywhere and from the hospital basement where adults and children are laid out awaiting someone to pick them up. The youngest still has an umbilical stump attached. Each airstrike and shell that relentlessly pounds Mariupol, about one a minute at times, drives home the curse of a geography that has put the city squarely in the path of Russia's domination of Ukraine. The southern seaport of 430,000 has become a symbol of Russian President Vladimir Putin's drive to crush democratic Ukraine, but also of a fierce resistance on the ground. In the 4 weeks since Russia's war began, two Associated Press journalists have been the only international media present in Mariupol, chronicling its fall into chaos and despair. The city is now encircled by Russian soldiers who are slowly squeezing the life out of it, one blast at a time. Several appeals for humanitarian corridors to evacuate civilians went unheeded until Ukrainian officials said last week that about 30,000 people had fled in convoys of cars. Airstrikes and shells have hit the maternity hospital, the fire department, homes, a church, a field outside a school. For the estimated hundreds of thousands who remain, there is quite simply nowhere to go. The surrounding roads are mined and the port blocked. Food is running out, and the Russians have stopped humanitarian attempts to bring it in. Electricity is mostly gone and water is sparse, with residents melting snow to drink. Some parents have even left their newborns at the hospital, perhaps hoping to give them a chance at life in the one place with decent electricity and water. People burn scraps of furniture and makeshift grills to warm their hands in the freezing cold and cook what little food there still is. The grills themselves are built with the one thing in plentiful supply, bricks and shards of metal scattered in the streets from destroyed buildings. Death is everywhere. Local officials have tallied more than 2,500 deaths in the siege, but many bodies can't be counted because of the endless shelling. They have told families to leave their dead outside in the streets because it's too dangerous to hold funerals. Just weeks ago, Mariupol's future seemed much brighter. If geography drives the city's destiny, Mariupol was on the path to success, with its thriving iron and steel plants, a deep water port, and high global demand for both. Even the dark weeks of 2014, when the city nearly fell to Russia-backed separatists and vicious street battles, were fading from memory. The first few days of the invasion had a perverse familiarity for many residents. About 100,000 people left at that time while they still could, according to Serhiy Orlov, the deputy mayor. But most stayed put, figuring they could wait out whatever came next or eventually make their way west like so many others. I felt more fear in 2014. I don't feel the same panic now, Anna Efimova said as she shopped for supplies at a market on February 24th. There is no panic. There's nowhere to run. Where can we run? Life was hardly normal, but it was livable. By February 27th, that started to change as an ambulance raced into a city hospital carrying a small, motionless girl, not yet six. Her brown hair was pulled back off her pale face with a rubber band, and her pajama pants were bloodied by Russian shelling. Her wounded father came with her, his head bandaged. Her mother stood outside the ambulance, weeping. As the doctors and nurses huddled around her, one gave her an injection. Another shocked her with a defibrillator. A doctor in blue scrubs, pumping oxygen into her, looked straight into the camera of an AP journalist, allowed inside and cursed. "Show this to Putin," he stormed with expletive-laced fury. "The eyes of this child and crying doctors." They couldn't save her. Doctors covered the tiny body with her pink striped jacket and gently closed her eyes. She now rests in the mass grave. The same geography that for so long worked in Mariupol's favor had turned against it. The city stands squarely between regions controlled by the Russian-backed separatists, about 10 kilometers, 6 miles to the east at the closest point, and the Crimean Peninsula annexed by Russia in 2014. The capture of Mariupol would give the Russians a clear land corridor all the way through, controlling the Sea of Azov. As February ended, the siege began. Ignoring the danger, or restless, or perhaps just feeling invincible as teenagers do, a group of boys met up a few days later, on March 2nd, to play soccer on a pitch outside of school. A bomb exploded. The blast tore through Ilya's legs. The odds were against him, and increasingly against the city. The electricity went out yet again, as did most mobile networks. Without communications, medics had to guess which hospitals could still handle the wounded and which roads could still be navigated to reach them. Ilya couldn't be saved. His father, Serhii, dropped down, hugged his dead boy's head, and wailed out his grief. On March 4th, there was yet another child in the emergency room, Kirill, the toddler struck in the head by shrapnel. His mother and stepfather bundled him in a blanket. They hoped for the best and then endured the worst. Why, his sobbing mother, Marina Yatsko, asked the hospital in the hallway as medical workers looked on helplessly. She tenderly unwrapped the blanket around her lifeless child to kiss him and inhale his scent one last time, her dark hair falling over him. That was the day the darkness settled in for good, a blackout in both power and knowledge. Ukrainian television and radio were cut. Car stereos became the only link to the outside world. They played Russian news, describing a world that couldn't be further from the reality. As it sank in that there was truly no escape, the mood of the city changed. It didn't take long for grocery store shelves to empty. Mariupol's residents cowered by night in underground shelters and emerged by day to grab what they could before scurrying underground again. On March 6th, in the way of desperate people everywhere, they turned on each other. On one street lined with darkened stores, people smashed windows, pried open metal shutters, grabbed what they could. A man who had broken into a store found himself face to face with the furious shopkeeper, caught red-handed with a child's rubber ball. "You bastard, you stole that ball now. Put the ball back. Why did you even come here?" she demanded. Shame written on his face, he tossed the ball into a corner and fled. Nearby, a soldier emerged from another looted store, on the verge of tears. "People, please be united. This is your home. Why are you smashing windows? Why are you stealing from your shops?" he pleaded, his voice breaking. In an underground shelter that night, Gomabjana wept beside an oil lamp that threw light but not enough heat to take the chill off the basement room. Beside her, people, beyond the small halo of light, a small group of women and children crouched in the darkness, trembling at the explosions above. "I want my home. I want my job. I'm so sad about people and about the city," the children, she sobbed. This agony fits in with Putin's goals. The siege is a military tactic popularized in medieval times and designed to crush a population through starvation and violence, allowing an attacking force to spare its own soldiers the cost of entering a hostile city. Instead, civilians are the ones left to die, slowly and painfully. By March 9th, the sound of Russian fighter jets in Mariupol was enough to send people screaming for cover. Anything to avoid the airstrikes they knew would follow, even if they didn't know where. The jets rumbled across the sky, this time decimating the maternity hospital. They left a crater 2 stories deep in the courtyard. Rescuers rushed a pregnant woman through the rubble and light snow as she stroked her bloodied belly, face blanched and head lolling listlessly to the side. Her baby was dying inside her, and she knew it, medics said. Kill me now, she screamed, as they struggled to save her life at another hospital even closer to the front line. The baby was born dead. Half hour later, the mother died too. The doctors had no time to learn either of their names. Another pregnant woman, Mariana, was waiting to give birth at the maternity hospital when the strike hit. Her brow and cheek bloodied, she clutched her belongings in a plastic bag and navigated the debris-strewn stairs in polka-dot pajamas. Outside the ruined hospital, she stared motionless with wide blue eyes at the crackling flames. She delivered her child the next day to the sound of shell fire. Baby Veronica drew her first breath on March 10th. The two women, one dead and one a mother, have since become the symbol of their blackened, burning hometown. 2 days after Veronica was born, four Russian tanks emblazoned with the letter Z took up a position near the hospital where she and her mother were recovering. An AP journalist was among a group of medical workers who came under sniper fire with one hit in the hip. The windows rattled and the hallways were lined with people with nowhere else to go. Anastasia Arashova wept and trembled as she held a sleeping child. Shelling had just killed her other child as well, and her brother's child, and Arashova's scalp was encrusted with blood. "I don't know where to run to," she cried out, her anguish growing with every sob. "Who will bring back our children? Who?" This story was originally published by the Associated Press. Here's one of the obituaries for you. The Sesame Street actor who sang in Spanish, Emilio Delgado, 1940 to 2022. Emilio Delgado won the hearts of millions of children over his 44 years on Sesame Street. Playing gentle fix-it shop owner Luis, he repaired picture frames and giant toasters while singing and sharing lessons about Latino culture. Delgado joined the iconic public TV show's cast for its third season in 1971 as the first human character to act alongside Muppets. He and Sonia Manzano, who played Maria, portrayed an innocent, drawn-out courtship, at one point dancing like Fred Astaire and Ginger Rogers to a song about the Spanish greeting, Hola. Finally, in a widely watched 1988 episode, Luis and Maria got married, teaching kids about love, family, and more subtly, diversity. For the first time on television, they showed Latinos as real human beings, Delgado said in 2019. Delgado was born in Calexico, California, but spent part of his childhood in Mexicali, Mexico, with his grandparents, crossing the border by foot every morning to attend school, said the Washington Post. Straddling two countries and cultures was easy for Delgado. "I remember going to sleep to the sound of mariachis," he said. After moving to Glendale, California, he served 6 years in the National Guard before pursuing his interest in theater by enrolling at the California Institute of the Arts, said Variety. Soon he was cast on Sesame Street as part of an initiative to boost the show's Spanish language segments. Incorporating his culture came naturally, said the New York Times. The first time Delgado saw Big Bird on the set, he didn't say bird, but rather pajaro, and producers had him continue mixing in Spanish words. Delgado, who later appeared on many adult-oriented TV shows, including Lou Grant, Hawaii Five-O, and House of Cards, took pride in rejecting caricature and playing fully realized people, especially as Luis. After their on-screen marriage, Luis and Maria welcomed a daughter, Gabriela, played for a time by Manzano's real-life daughter. Some viewers were sad to discover Delgado and Manzano weren't married in real life. Delgado said that when he started in TV, many Latinos could only get roles playing banditos, gang members, low-life characters, and sleeping Mexicans under a cactus. But on Sesame Street, he said, there were different people who spoke different languages and ate interesting foods, and they were all Americans. Here's a health and science piece. Dogs take your pain away. Therapy dogs, long used to comfort people in nursing homes and schools and even at disaster sites, could be useful in the emergency room, too. In a new study, researchers at the University of Saskatchewan asked more than 200 ER patients to record their pain levels. About half the people were then given a 10-minute encounter with a therapy dog, after which both groups were asked again how much pain they were in. Sure enough, the patients the pooch visited reported less pain, as well as less anxiety and depression. Nearly half said they were less anxious, and 43% had experienced pain relief. The study also reports that the ER environment itself seemed to contribute to people's pain, possibly because of the constant bright lights and noise, and that the dog was a welcome distraction. Therapy dogs are just really friendly family pets that are so excited to visit with people and in places where you don't typically have a pet, co-author Colleen Dell tells NPR.org. Going into the emergency department was a natural. Dell says that although many people say they have benefited from therapy dogs, this study clinically proves that they are indeed helpful. And we're on the Talking Points page now. Hunter Biden, the laptop really was his. As hard as liberals have tried to plug their noses, the stink from Hunter Biden's mounting legal problems can no longer be ignored, said Gerard Baker in the Wall Street Journal. Last week, the New York Times reported that President Biden's 52-year-old son recently paid more than $1 million in tax liabilities in hopes of avoiding an indictment. As a grand jury weighs whether to charge him with violating foreign lobbying and money laundering laws. Federal prosecutors have spent several years investigating Biden's overseas business dealings in Ukraine, China, and Kazakhstan while his father was vice president, a time when Hunter was deep in the throes of drug addiction and selling his high-level family political connections to foreigners for millions in payments and gifts. In its story, the Times even confirmed a bombshell pre-election story from the conservative New York Post that the media ignored for 17 months. Biden really did leave a laptop at a Delaware repair shop that contained possibly incriminating emails about his foreign dealings. Journalists had every reason to approach this story with caution, said Philip Bump in the Washington Post. When the Rupert Murdoch-owned Post reported it had data from the laptop 3 weeks before the 2020 election, it came after former President Trump's lawyer, Rudy Giuliani, spent months openly digging in Ukraine for dirt about Hunter that might damage his father. The Post refused to let any other media organization examine the data, and no one would explain why the owner of the repair shop gave it to Giuliani. Given Russia's interference in the 2016 election, mainstream media understandably responded with suspicion. Actually, the media conspired with Democrats to discredit the laptop and bury the story, said Byron York in the Washington Examiner. Candidate Biden falsely insisted that the laptop story was a Russian plant, and more than 50 former intelligence officials said it had all the classic earmarks of a Russian information operation. Facebook and Twitter banned the laptop story from their platforms. Even today, said Jim Garrity in National Review, with a grand jury considering evidence on Hunter, Democrats act like there's something rude or unseemly about saying, hey, this looks like the backdoor bribery or influence peddling. Because Hunter is such an embarrassment to his father's party, a lot of liberals prefer to avert their eyes and change the subject. Russia and Ukraine, China's big dilemma. As the war in Ukraine grinds on, Chinese President Xi Jinping faces a crucial choice, said Katie Stollard in the New Statesman. Weeks after declaring there were no limits to the friendship between him and top ally Russian President Vladimir Putin, Xi faces growing international pressure to condemn Putin's aggression and work toward a ceasefire. So far, China has resisted such pressure. Instead, Chinese officials have parroted Russia's blaming of NATO for the crisis and abstained from UN resolutions condemning the war. But Russia is reportedly asking for military and economic aid, and in a two-hour call last week, President Biden warned Xi not to get involved. Xi knows that Chinese companies and financial institutions could be sanctioned if they become accessories to Russia's brutal war effort, and China could find itself on the wrong side of a new global divide. China won't go all in on backing Putin, said Min-Sin Pai in Bloomberg. It would risk an immediate confrontation with the West, for which China is not prepared. The U.S., Europe, and Japan accounted for 52% of China's foreign trade last year, while Russia accounted for 3.8%. China relies on microchips and other advanced Western technology, and its large businesses and banks can't afford to be cut off from the dollar. Many analysts agree that for a dominant player in the global supply chains, China just can't risk lining up behind Putin, said Courtney Subramanian in USA Today. The economy is paramount, and China has a lot more to lose on this than Russia, said Andrew Scovell, a China expert at the U.S. Institute for Peace. Still, don't expect China to cut its ties with Russia, said Stephen Lee Myers and Chris Buckley in the New York Times. Xi sees his deepening alliance with Russia as an important counterweight to the U.S. and the West. Meanwhile, as Russia becomes a global pariah, analysts say Moscow will become increasingly beholden to China as its diplomatic and economic lifeline. Ultimately, China hopes to stay on its tightrope, rise above what it considers a struggle between two tired powers, and be seen as a pillar of stability in an increasingly turbulent world. In Beijing, the abiding hope is that when the dust settles, one country stands to emerge victorious from the turmoil. China. And we'll read some of the shorter notes. Ivermectin, the antiparasitic drug touted as a COVID cure by many anti-vaccine politicians and media figures, showed no therapeutic value against the disease in a large-scale study. Among nearly 1,400 high-risk COVID patients, those who received the drug, which is primarily used for parasitic diseases in humans and livestock, fared no better than those who received a placebo. Some 4.9 million Americans say they've relocated since 2020 because of the opportunity to work remotely, according to the Upwork survey. Another 18.9 million say they plan to move because of remote work. Of those surveyed, 28% said they're moving more than 4 hours away from their jobs. The U.S. has resettled only about 690 Ukrainians since October, and only a handful of the more than 3.5 million who have fled since the Russian invasion. Though Congress has approved $1.4 billion to help with the Ukrainian refugee crisis, the refugee admissions process became so backed up after the Trump administration, which capped refugee admissions at 15,000, that Ukrainians have no hope of coming to the U.S. 23 states no longer require a permit to carry a concealed weapon, which means people can buy guns without background checks or safety training. In Ohio, about 2,000 applicants were denied permits last year, but can now buy and carry weapons. On the poll watch, 55% of Americans think Ketanji Brown Jackson should be confirmed as a Supreme Court justice. 53% support Biden's decision to nominate a black woman, including 80% of black Americans and 45% of white Americans. 82% of Democrats think Jackson should be confirmed, compared with 29% of Republicans. And we'll get two of the quotes today. The first comes from Dorothy Parker, quoted in the Catholic Star Herald. Hollywood is the one place on earth where you could die of encouragement. And Jonathan Swift, quoted in the Washington Post, says, falsehood flies and truth comes limping after it. And with that, we have run out of time for today's episode of the week. Be sure to listen again next time. We hope you've enjoyed it. This is Fred Woodward reading for the North Carolina Reading Service. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. The week is available as a podcast on our website, ncreadingservice.org. For more information, if you have comments or questions, please call us at 919-832-5138. That number again is 919-832-5138. And thank you for listening to the North Carolina Reading Service.